And it was on, and again on these occasions it was, well, except we were political campaigns, of course, they were different. We'd still have our scotches and soda at the end of a day of politicking, campaigning, but we'd talk a bit of politics then, and how things had gone and so on during the day, or how I saw things, and because it was always interesting to sit at the back of a hall when in those days Menzies would most of the addresses would be in town halls and things like that, and of course he was a master, I think, at using the hecklers, and he would encourage hecklers to give him something to bounce off. And instead of my sitting down the front with, say, Dame Patty or other Liberal Party people, I'd generally wander around the back of the hall so I could get a better view of what was happening and, you know, where the hecklers were coming from, and then later seeing how they were using spotlight torches to signal to each other when to heckle and things. And so I had something to talk about over the scotch and soda when we got back to base.
What was the issue back then
that
would have aroused such intensity at public meetings, town hall meetings?
Aid to church schools was one, and you're moving into the Vietnam War issue, but things like aid to state schools was a big one at times when. Because education was often one of the issues that was raised in the election campaign. And on the campaigning, the technique of Menzies' basic technique was to use three issues over a week or whatever the campaign. He might have, say, foreign affairs and defence and education, and he'd talk about two of them one day, and then he'd talk about another two the next day, and then he'd switch them around and talk about the other two out of the three, just, you know, move them around a bit. But, you know, talk on three or four issues during the campaign rather than a new issue every day, which has been brought on today where the media aren't satisfied to get into any... And not that you had to put too much detail, it was a matter of putting forward your principles for pushing an idea forward into the future, not having to detail every dollar that was going to be spent or how many people would be affected. So that's changed very dramatically since those days, largely because of the media, I think.
Yes. Did Menzies strike you as somebody who really believed in what he... espoused politically, like say with the state aid issue?
Yes, very much so. I think he certainly gave that impression that you know it was all from the heart or all thought out sort of stuff. The state aid issue, I know, because there's a lot of politics in that, because a lot of the Catholic churches were often at that stage being encouraged to vote Labour from the pulpit, or that was the feeling. And there was also, so apart from that political issue and trying to persuade, trying to get some of that Catholic vote, there was also the issue of education, because if the church schools closed down, the public schools couldn't cope. And there was a lot of talk about the increasing cost of church schools, and people getting a bit disgruntled that why should the public school kids who's, you know, be paid out from the taxpayers' fund, whereas the church school kids have, you know, got to be paid by their parents' education. So there was a fair bit of fuss on that one, and. As I understand at the time, the way Menzies broke that great argument about taxpayer money should only go to state schools was to give both state and private schools money for libraries and for science blocks. And I think that was the beginning of the breakdown of the taxpayer money going to private schools.
Mm-hmm. I asked the original question about sincerity because I thought you would be very well placed to know what he really felt, because presumably over a martini or whatever, these he would express a personal view.
They would come out, yes. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've got no idea, no doubt that you know, he was sincere in the sort of policies he was projecting. And of course, he was such a, at that stage, you know, at the last of his, what, he'd been Prime Minister for, at the end, what, 19 years, I think it was, all up. He knew what he stood for, knew where he was going, and he was an authority in the party. And, you know, I don't think there was much opposition if he put forward ideas, apart from Jack McEwen at times, on the trade side and things, who had his own ideas there. But I think he was a very sincere sort of person, from my experience.
Did he ever mention the Petrov?
No, not really. I was in the department at the time, but no, it never came up as a real issue. At any stage.
I asked you with Holt about his intellect. What would you say about Menzies at the intellectual level?
Well, I've seen reported that he's probably, you know, one of the most widely read prime ministers that Australia's ever had. I would class him more in that intellectual capacity, in terms of his reading and pulling threads together. And I think he'd look probably more at the principles behind things than making an ad hoc decision for political gain. I'm not saying that he ignored political gain, I think he'd want to see some principles behind what the government was doing. And this is where a lot of the difference is now too. I think in those days he could espouse sort of some objective or noble cause or whatever. Some general view of the future, or like for the ACT, he was very keen to have a capital in the ACT and the National Capital Development Authority, whatever it was called. Overall, wasn't it? Yeah.
That's right, Sir John Overall.
Sir John Overall, yeah, he was very keen on that and pushed that pretty hard to get that sort of the development of Canberra going. It was one of those things that he felt was needed to symbolic as much as anything. I think the development of Canberra as a centre of government for the country. Because having seen things overseas, you realise that, you know, in Australia, you know, we're way behind in terms of pushing our nationality and pushing a lot of this symbolism. For instance, you know, Kirribilli House, people jumped up and down when they developed Kirribilli House as a guest house for overseas visitors, which would be used for the PM when he was in Sydney, but also for overseas visitors. And but if you go to places like Seoul and Korea and places, Thailand and other places, and some of their guest houses that they put visitors in are just magic, you know, sort of really, really fancy class. But it does give these countries an opportunity to display some of their history and culture and stuff and spread the gospel, if you like. Mm. Whereas Australians seem to have condemn that here as terms of unnecessary expenditure in restoring an old building in Sydney on a prime site.
Now, during your time with Menzies, it was Corwell was still opposition leader.
He was.
And then replaced in 67, I think, by Whitlam.
Yes.
What were the dealings and the relationship like between the opposition and the Prime Minister's office?
I thought they were very good. I mean, if the PM was to make a speech, we'd always make sure that Corwell's office had it sort of an hour beforehand. It was all pretty cooperative, except on one occasion, I remember, there was a statement the PM was to make at 8 o'clock, and at 6 or 6:15 or something, I delivered a copy around to Corwell's office. I forget what the subject was now, but it was something of, you know, obviously of current interest, because the next morning I got up and I found the front page of the Canberra Times, a great headline, Menzies ignores Corwell, and there's, you know, fuss about not being given advance notice of this statement that the PM was to make. I think Parliament was to meet at 10:30 that next morning, or that morning's. So I had to brush everything aside and quickly draft out a timetable as to when I took things around to Corwell's office and so on, and jot this down in dot points so that the PM would have it before question time. And sure enough, the first question, Corwell accusing the PM of ignoring him and not keeping him in the picture, and of course Menzies said, well, at 6:15 this happened, and at 6:30, and so, you know, this was part of the job, that you never knew what was going to happen the next day. And you had to just work ad hoc, actually, and push everything else aside until you got the urgent stuff done. But apart from that instance, I can't think of another where there wasn't cooperation on both sides. Of course, there was a lot of sympathy when Corwell had that bloke had a go at him with a shotgun.
Yes.
I don't recall any other occasions apart from that one where there was any conflict between the two, and certainly my association with Whitlam's office was much the same, always cooperative with whoever was there, John Menzies or Peter Cullen, his research bloke. I had a lot of time with Peter, surprisingly, we invited to his 50th birthday party, which was a surprise party, where there were, you know, lots of Labor people there, including a couple of Labor ministers and so on down the track. So those sort of relationships worked, and I think I could truthfully say I had more beers with Labor Party staffers those days than I did with Liberal staffers.
Did you meet Corwell at all?
Yes, not very often. I didn't have much personal contact with Corwell, but certainly met most of those parliamentarians around at the time.
Did you pick up any impression of how Menzies regarded Corwell?
I suppose I could only say I think the attitude was friendly, but I don't know how he saw him. He didn't see him as a strong political opponent, I don't think, and certainly didn't see him as an intellectual opponent. But I don't think I could. I don't think there was any arrogance in that sort of feeling at all. I think that might have been about the assessment. and I think he saw the conflicts within the Labor Party of, you know, the likes of Corwell, the old time with the young bull, Whitlam coming up, who was the intellectual academic type, as being something that was probably a conflict within the Labor Party that, you know, wouldn't lead to a lot of unity. So one thing that I do recall about Menzies too, which is not relevant to what you're saying, but he did encourage some of the up-and-coming backbenchers to do overseas trips, parliamentary trips. And two that he did select, I remember while I was with him, was Malcolm Fraser, who went to America and did some work on extension in primary industry extension work, and Don Chipp, who he picked out too as a, you know, potential ministerial sort of material. And I don't know what Don Chipp studied overseas, but the idea was they go overseas, but they come back and report to the PM.
Yeah.
And so there were two that he picked as backbenchers and who sort of went far in the political field here. So he had some nous in terms of selecting people showing talent in particular areas.
And of course, we always read about, you know, young Harold, as it's commonly put.
Yes.
Did you ever hear him use that term, or do you think that's an accurate reflection of how he saw Holt?
No, I used to call him Young Harold, I think, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think he saw him as a very competent treasurer, a very competent minister. Because it was he must have picked him out early too, because it was I think it was Menzies who had Holt pulled out of the army to become a minister when that plane crash out of Canberra killed three or four ministers, three ministers and a couple of top military personnel.
Yes.
So I think it was Menzies obviously had him picked out then and had him withdrawn from the army to become a minister.
You know, another common caricature of Menzies relates to him being almost more British than Australian,
yes.
You know, and the thing with the Queen,
yes.
Saying how much he loved her and all that in that poem.
Yeah.
Do you have any comment on that from your dealings with Menzies?
Only that I would say it was a genuine feeling.
Mm-hmm.
He was genuinely interested in the royalty and generally wanted that good contact with Britain. And yeah, British to the bootstraps, that doesn't surprise me at all. I don't think that he ever minded that sort of tag. I know these things are often used to ridicule, but I don't think it ever bothered him at all. And he certainly loved going to Britain. I never went with him at any stage, but actually, I didn't travel overseas at all with Menzies. No, I don't think he'd have any qualms about that association. It was, I think, it was genuine. And you know, sort of, I think it even flowed through later when he was instrumental in getting the Churchill Fellowships sort of up and going. A lot of that was done from this office. And, you know, a lot of young Australians and middle-aged Australians have benefited from those scholarships and in various walks of life since then. So, no, I think he had a great admiration for Churchill and for royal family and Britain in toto.
Have you read many of the biographies?
Not really. I've got quite a few of them that I've been collecting in recent years. But I haven't completely read any of them actually.
Well, have you been involved? Like, did any of the authors invite you to help them with information and recollection?
No, I've heard from nobody who's done any writing. They may have gone to Hazel Craig, who had a longer association and a more personal association than I've had. No, I've heard from no one or in that area. I could say too that I, in my job, I treated it. I didn't get involved in the personal life as much as some other private secretaries did and do. For instance, I think I've only eaten at the lodge probably twice. Other staffers would get out there, you know, sort of every second week if they had a chance. But I tried to separate. Well, apart from the fact that I had young kids of my own and I needed a bit of family time, I felt that prime ministers need their family time and their break time as well. And I didn't feel that, you know, I should be imposing on their, well, private time, as I put it, as much as prime ministers can have private time. But I thought they should have as much break and private time as they could get. And that's why I deliberately didn't get too much involved in the lodge or going to the lodge. Although when I had young fellows getting to the Boy Scout sort of stage, Dame Patty sort of invited me out there to collect bottles from time to time for the Boy Scouts to sell, and then there was always, you know, oh, go and see the garden and get some asparagus and stuff, and so, you know, it was always that sort of friendly relationship when it happened. But again, I just didn't like interrupting too much in that area.
In 1965-66, what was the condition of your family?
Condition of my family in 65-66. I married in 53, and by then I would have had probably four kids, two boys and two girls at that stage, I would think, yeah. And we were living in O'Connor, Boobiella Street, O'Connor. And part of that time a bit earlier, before I started Parliament House, I was working on a milk run.
Jay.
While I studied part-time at the Canberra University College. I know that would have been in the 50s. I did a commerce degree at the Canberra University College part-time, which took me 6 years part-time. And I ran a milk run.
Now, what was
and I worked overtime.
Yeah, gee. Milk run, where was that?
Oh, you'd cover three or four suburbs here in Canberra, yeah.
O'Connor and yeah. Inner North.
Yes, yeah, in that inner north bit. You'd have to pick up the milk at, you always had to have your milk back by 8 o'clock. Had to be delivered before then. And so I'd start about 3 a.m. and pick up the milk from the factory and back and deliver the any leftovers back before 8 o'clock, get back home, get dressed, get to work by 8:30. And I used to grow enough vegetables for the family, and at one stage I was even growing seedlings to sell. I don't think too many young fellows do that today.
No, that's your farm background.
Yeah.
Yes. How did you deliver the milk?
A truck, milk delivered in bottles. We used to carry about, you know, we had baskets that carry about 10 or 12 bottles each, and we'd just run from place to place, shop to shop, house to house. And, Saturday morning you'd go around and collect the bills and a few things. So, you know, time was full.
Yeah. Now, Frank, I'm looking at the time, talking of time. We've gone for about 2 hours. You've done really well. I hope you've enjoyed the session.
I have, yes.
And I think we can, if you don't mind, I'd like to continue with Menzies next time.
Right.
Keep talking about Menzies and his retirement before moving on to Holt.
Right.
But for today, let's end this session now and we can meet tomorrow. Is that
That's
still
fine.
Okay?
That's fine, Barry, yes.
Good. Okay.
Okay. Thanks for that.